Dmitry Filipovich, and joining me is my good buddy Arpan Basu. Arpan, what's going on, man?
How are you, man? It's been too long.
It has been. When it was last time we chatted was the 2019 draft, when we had some beers at my place and talked about the Canadians.
Yeah, it was a different world back then. A lot has changed.
It has. We're doing this remotely, but no, this is gonna be fun. We're gonna hear to deep dive the Montreal Canadiens, as people would expect when they see they hear the guest. And you know what? They've become the talk of the league. Last week, I did a pod with Michael Russo, and it felt like it was very topical because Kirill Kaprizov sort of took the league by storm, and everyone was talking about him. And now, through the first 2 weeks, it feels like the team that has really kind of generated the most attention, or has really kind of opened people's eyes the most, has been the Canadiens. So it feels kind of fitting to give them a little bit of a deep dive here after the start they're off to.
Yeah, it's you know, I mean, it's honestly, it's kind of hard to, judge, I guess, because the one thing I'm struggling with is, like, does this say more about the Canadiens, or does this say more about the Oilers and the Canucks? Because basically, those are the two teams they've played, right? They played the Maple Leafs once, but the other five games were against those two teams, and they're two, you know, exciting teams with talented players, but they have their flaws. So it's hard to judge, but just from watching them so far, it just appears that they don't have many glaring holes. I mean, obviously, they don't have that kind of top-end talent that both Vancouver and Edmonton does have, and Toronto, actually, their three opponents so far. But, you know, there's no weak link, like, in the sense, you know, I've always made the big strong link sport versus weak link sport thing with hockey, and the Canadiens seem to be, like, on a mission to prove that hockey is a weak link sport, because right now, the further down the lineup you go, the more the advantage tilts to the Canadiens, and I feel like they're taking advantage of that.
Well, it's easy to see why people are excited. You know, when you start a year off on a six-game road trip in which you go 4-0-2, you take 10 of 12 possible points, you score a league-high 29 goals, you're sporting a league-best plus 12 goal differential. Just from the eye test, they really steamrolled, especially, you know, the Oilers and the Canucks for large stretches of play. I think part of why people are excited, though, beyond just the fact that they've been fun to watch and they have had good results, is we entered this season kind of looking at this depth chart, as you mentioned, with the weak link aspect of it, and saying, listen, this team looks really deep. They're prepared for whatever uncertainties are going to be thrown their way this season, especially with the condensed schedule. I think it's going to come into play. They're going to play really fast. This could be a problem, and it could be really entertaining. And they come out of the gate looking exactly like that, kind of like the best case scenario. So I think early season confirmation bias is a real thing, where especially for this team, they were such like a trendy sleeper pick, because right out of the gate, everyone picked Toronto to come out of this division. And then there was a bit of a pushback of, oh, well, you know what? The Canadiens look pretty interesting, and people kind of zag when other people are zigging. And it feels like I think there's a bit of that confirmation bias where you just watch it and you're like, oh yeah, like we were onto something. It's kind of like that Leo DiCaprio pointing meme where you're just watching it and you're like, aha, that's it. Yeah, that's the thing.
Exactly.
And so I think part of that does have to do with this, where if this stretch happened during the middle of the season, I think people would certainly point to it and go, oh wow, this is a great six game run for them. Let's see if it continues. But just because it's the first six game sample right out of the gate, I think people are going to latch onto it that much more.
Yeah, I agree with that to a certain extent. I mean, I think that the one thing I think is that the people who were sort of touting the Canadiens before the season began were some of the more old school types, some of the people who liked that they got bigger on defense, that they got bigger in general, that they could play a heavier game, that they got more playoff ready, quote unquote, you know, and you know, the one question that I had, and I think a lot of people had, is that With a short training camp and no exhibition schedule, how is a team that made so many changes going to look coming out of the gate? So that's why I think that early season confirmation bias comes in, because the expectation was that it was going to take them some time to gel and come together and improve. And honestly, that's still the case. This team is not playing as well as they could be playing. They're playing actually pretty poor defensively, which is kind of Claude Julien's, you know, kryptonite. Like it drives him crazy. And so that's going to change. And that's where the gelling sort of comes in. And you look at guys like, you know, I remember I've spoken to several actually NHL scouts who always, you know, when Shea Weber gets off to a slow start, or Ben Sherrod, or bigger guys who get off to slow starts, NHL scouts tend to write it off. Mm-hmm. They're like, you know what, bigger guys, it takes them longer to get going, and they'll be fine. Don't worry. And I've always kept that in mind. So like Joel Edmondson has a terrible night on opening night, and people spent the entire offseason ripping that signing. Like, it did not look like a smart signing at all. And then he goes out on opening night and kind of proves that. But as every game has gone along, he's looked better and better. Then the other night, you know, listen, I'm not a code guy, but you know, for him to go out and do what he did the other night with Tyler Myers, that plays big in the room. Whether I like it or not is irrelevant. His teammates likes that stuff. And so, you know, we're going to see these little moments over the coming weeks and months, I guess, but I mean, definitely over the coming weeks, where I think you will see, you know, some chinks in the armor, if you will. The Canadiens are going to look like a new team. They're going to look like they haven't been playing together for years, but there are also going to be other elements of their game that are going to steadily improve as some of the players who just came in get used to the system and the environment and everything that comes with being a member of the team.
Well, let's get into the six games. And I think, you know, there are the sort of the normal early season disclaimers and caveats where it's like, we're only talking about six games. I think ideally we'd be looking at 15 to 20 games at least to really have any sort of major conclusions, especially with the numbers. But listen, like, especially in this weird season, this already accounts for over 10% of the schedule. So it's certainly not an insignificant period of time. I think the natural pushback, and you raised this at the top, was it's come against some, let's be generous and say loose defensive structures. half their games have come against this Canucks team that's just completely unraveling before our eyes. I think their defense in particular has been disastrous now that they don't have Vezina caliber goaltending to bail them out. I think there were stretches during that three game series where it really looked like it was like all-star game level setting where there was just so many two-on-ones.
I felt really bad for Thatcher Demko, man. That night, like, he couldn't come out because he needed Holtby. It was verging on like a Patrick Waugh scenario. Like, I mean, there was one goal that went in and you could tell he was really angry to still be in the game. And I felt bad for him.
I mean, Clearside Analytics had them as, had 13 expected goals for the Canadiens in those three games, which is like just an astronomical bonkers number. Yeah, I know you really don't see that. Cause usually, like, you know, a team can have a strong three game stretch where they score a bunch of goals, but you'll usually see that their actual goals are significantly ahead of the expected goals. And in this case, like the amount of chances, especially high danger ones, the Canucks were conceding was alarming to say the least. Now, what I would say to that is, listen, like, this is kind of what we expected from the North Division. I think we're expecting a lot of sort of track meet, open-ended, high-scoring games. And these are the teams they're exclusively facing this season. So we kind of, that's all we have to judge them on. You can't go like, oh, well, this division is poor. Especially, like, I think most people projected Vancouver and Edmonton to be playoff teams in this division. And you're thinking, okay, well, like, these are the teams they're going to play a bunch of times. And they haven't even played the Jets and the Sens yet. And I think you could argue that those are even more porous defensive teams. So this is kind of, I think, going to be the standard. We're not necessarily going to see seven goals every night, but I do think more often than not, we're going to see some pretty open-ended games.
I also have a theory on, because the one thing that struck me against both the Canucks and the Oilers, and even the Maple Leafs in that one game, is how many breakaways the Canadiens are getting. You know, and I've thought about it because you could chalk this up to early season, you know, defensive lapses and that's probably a big chunk of what's happening here. But I do think that the way the Canadiens are structured and the way they play an extremely high pressure brand of forechecking. Like, they do not give you any room to breathe when you have the puck. If you have the puck, you're going to have a Canadiens forward on you very, very quickly. And you need to make a quick decision with that puck or else something bad's going to happen. So I think the further along you get in games, that becomes somewhat mentally exhausting. Like, it just becomes, it becomes difficult to perform under those circumstances when it's line after line after line after line doing the exact same thing. You know, a lot of teams have good forechecking lines, or maybe two good forechecking lines, but not many teams have four lines the way the Canadiens come at you in that way, in a forechecking style and in a style that is constantly hounding the puck and pressuring it and just making you think and making you remain sharp. And so as the game goes along, I think that style kind of lends itself to creating those lapses and creating those mistakes. And I will see if this is proven right as we go along. I mean, you know, the Canadiens are welcoming. They have a little stretch here where they have no games. Thursday night, they finally play their home opener and they're welcoming the Flames. And I think the Flames are probably the one team in the division that is not a defensive tire fire. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's their team that can actually defend and has a good group on defense. So let's see what happens. I mean, I'm really curious to see how the Canadiens fare against a team that has as good of a structure and as good of a personnel or a group of defensemen as the Flames do. I think it's going to be a really interesting sort of measuring stick for this team.
I'm with you. I think that's the thing that I've highlighted as worth most monitoring moving forward is how they've been creating these scoring opportunities specifically. I think, you know, certainly their skating and sort of this relentless pace they play at helps. Like the forecheck, I think, generally tends to lead to higher frequency and just higher event hockey at both ends of the ice because it kind of stretches out the ice surface. You're not necessarily just spending a bunch of time just kind of stuck in the neutral zone. It feels like something's happening at one end of the ice or the other. I think the other thing is what I've noticed is they've really been aggressive and by design, it looks like, in terms of leaking out in transition, kind of especially pressuring and contesting the blue line in the defensive zone. And the reason why I bring that up, I think, is notable is because I think it was the other day Claude Julien kind of highlighted it in one of his pressers where he was talking about how they've been leaving a lot of unattended ice in that kind of home plate area and the slot area, and that's been a point of concern for them. And that's going to happen. I think that's kind of the drawback. It's just the geometry of the ice where if you have two of your players up near the blue line contesting and looking to fly the zone, that's going to leave a lot of room open in the middle of the ice. I do think ultimately it's a net positive. I love the mindset. I love playing aggressively that way. I think the rewards outweigh the risks in the long run, but we know how NHL coaches feel. And you mentioned how Claude Julien feels about it. I think I'd imagine that's going to be something they're going to look to tighten up. And I'm curious to see how that's going to impact those results, especially offensively, because it seems like they're kind of using that to their advantage to create a bit more than they normally would.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I would agree that Claude Julien eventually is going to want to tilt that risk balance, if you will, in terms of I'd rather not risk giving up a goal than risk getting one. It's always been his natural instinct. The Canadiens do have, you know, when you looked at them before the season, you saw Philip Deneau, elite level two-way centerman in the sense defensive play, and not a great offensive centerman, but a really, really good defensive centerman, and good enough offensively that he can sort of serve as a facilitator on his line. So you have that, you know, Selke caliber guy, and then you have three really young centers. And so what's happened so far is that two of those young centers, at the very least, have shown to be extremely competent in their own end. You know, Nick Suzuki and Jake Evans can play in their own end at an NHL level. They're not necessarily a liability defensively. Nick Suzuki's definitely not. His hockey IQ and intelligence is off the charts, and he can figure it out. And Jake Evans, who's a rookie, but is a 24-year-old rookie who played 2 years in the American Hockey League and has been groomed for this role for 2 years by Joel Bouchard with the Laval Rocket, gets it as well to a level that I did not expect him to get it at right now. So that allows you, I think, to leak a winger out from time to time, knowing that you have that level of depth in terms of defensive competency at the center position, and the amount of speed they have on the wings. So, like, you know, Suzuki has Jonathan Drouin and Josh Anderson. Josh Anderson, who is way faster than I knew. Like, I had seen him play, and I knew he was fast. I did not know he was this fast.
He's almost too fast for his own good, I think.
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, I anticipate many goaltender interference penalties coming to that guy just because he won't be able to stop in time. But he's fast, and he takes the puck to the net. Like, he has a wide enough frame that he can shield off a defender and go to the net. And he's done it at least four or five times this season already. And so with that kind of speed on the wing, you know, you have Tatar and Gallagher on the Deneau line as well. And even Lehkonen and Byron on the Evans line, which is the fourth line, they are two extremely fast wingers. And Arturi Lehkonen said, for the first time in my career, I feel I'm the slowest guy on my line. Which is something, because Lehkonen is a plus skater. Like, he has his faults, but skating's not one of them. So with that combination, I think Julien eventually will be able to find a balance there. Like, I think at some point he's going to clamp down. He's going to be like, okay, that's it. We're taking care of our own end. And then once they get that figured out, then maybe he can start incorporating the stuff we've seen so far and find a better balance between the two.
Well, they've also been, you know, able to kind of capitalize and take advantage of the opportunities. I think while it's easy to point at they're shooting nearly 14% overall and like 12.2% at 5-on-5, that's clearly not going to continue, because as we know, like last year, no team shot 10% at 5-on-5 and the Lightning led the league at 11% overall. Like that's going to regress with more games, obviously, regardless of what the defensive environment is like. But I imagine for this team, you know, part of it is infusing the lineup with more skill and young players getting better. But part of it, I imagine, is also that like they're relishing the fact that finally, this is a team that historically, especially over the past couple of years, has been near the bottom in terms of converting on those opportunities. And now, like, it's I guess, a well-deserved little stretch, kind of like a respite for them, where they're actually turning that volume into actual results, as opposed to being one of those analytical darlings like the Carolina Hurricanes, for example, where it's like, oh, look at all the shot volume, and they're like bottom five in shooting percentage for the full season.
Yeah, but there's, you know, I think these two things go hand in hand that we've been talking about, is that they're generating better opportunities. Like that's really what's happening here. They're getting more 2-on-1s, 3-on-1s, breakaways. It's a lot more, you know, I think a lot of that shot volume in the past came from their ability to play in the offensive zone, to cycle the puck, to kind of own the walls and maintain possession for long stretches of time and put a lot of pucks towards the net. But they weren't necessarily the most dangerous shots. You know, I mean, they have good expected goal numbers. Everything was good, but, you know, they had trouble getting to the middle of the ice in the past couple of years, you know, other than the Deno line, which did a decent job of that because you had Brendan Gallagher, and Brendan Gallagher just lives in the middle of the ice. But I mean, there was no depth in terms of being able to create opportunities from that home plate area. And now you have players on every line almost that can do that. I mean, maybe not the Lekkonen and Byron Evans line, though Byron's pretty good at it. But, you know, you have Tyler Toffoli on that third line with Kotkaniemi and Armia, who's also pretty good at that. Then you obviously have Anderson and Drouin playing with a facilitator and a smart player like Suzuki, which is been their best offensive line so far. And Josh Anderson lives in that middle area of the ice. And then you have Gallagher. So you have a guy on every line that can kind of create those opportunities, those higher leverage, those higher end opportunities that I think they've been creating in the past, which has resulted in the higher shooting percentage, which will go down. But if they continue producing breakaways and these rush opportunities every game, then I don't know how far it will go down. It'll go down somewhat, but I think they can maintain a pretty high shooting percentage, definitely compared to their prior years, if they continue creating the quality of opportunities that they've been creating so far.
Yeah, certainly. There is a regression coming in that regard, but I think they're well suited to absorb it just because of the volume. But also, as you mentioned, I think playing off the rush and creating your offense at 5-on-5 off the rush is kind of a life hack in hockey, where it's a much different expected outcome than, you know, just cycling in the offensive zone and then getting it out to the point and kind of throwing it on net, as we often see teams that lack that sort of dynamic skating have to resort to. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot here to consider. I want to talk more about Suzuki. It feels like you've mentioned him a little bit, and we're 20 minutes in here and we haven't fully talked about it yet, which I commend us for. But I think the most impressive thing about him so far for me is that he's managed to somehow exceed his expectations that I had for him, which seems almost impossible given the market he's playing in and how hyped he was after the playoffs. I did a season preview with our friend Andrew Berkshire before the season, and we kind of highlighted him as a breakout player, and it felt like cheating a little bit because you could argue he'd already broken out, but I felt like the case was there because it felt like he is kind of the key that could help unlock a different type of ceiling for this Habs team, especially offensively with his skill level. And we've sort of seen that already through the first couple games, whether it's on the power play or whether it is at 5-on-5 with Drouin and Anderson, where their ability to create all of a sudden takes this team from being, you know, a good, feisty, fast team that is deep to potentially having a player that actually can match the skill level and the ability to create that some of these other thinner teams have with their star players.
Well, I think the thing with Nick Suzuki is that you watch him play, and if you watch his highlights, let's say, you just like, you're wow. You're like, wow, that's a really crafty, skilled player. But And I admit that I'm sort of cheating. I got a piece coming out this week on sort of the little things in Suzuki's game that really make him very effective. They happen almost on every shift. They're little stick lifts from behind that create sort of a bad pass, or you know, the way he angles guys off when he forechecks, the way he's become surprisingly more physical. He's you know, he's 5'11", 210, something like that. Like he's a thick guy. Mm. And so he's starting to use that. I mean, there were two or three times against Vancouver when he was in a confrontation with Pettersson, who's not the strongest guy in the world, but still it was a physical confrontation and Suzuki's the one left standing. It's, you know, I don't think he deserves a medal for out muscling Elias Pettersson, but still he's showing that's an element of his game that he's willing to use at a relatively young age. It usually takes players a couple of years before they feel confident to physically assert themselves at the NHL level. And he's doing that this season. So what I find so interesting for him as a prospect is that, or as a young player, I should say, is that yes, he has the high end skill and he has the vision and the IQ and everything that will make a great offensive player, but he has all these other layers to his game that most young players don't, that takes most young players many years to develop. And, you know, I feel, you know, it's not right. Like Jonathan Drouin the other day said, he's a mini Patrice Bergeron. Mm. The comparison has been used many, many times already. I don't think it's all that fair. Because Patrice Bergeron. He's almost a perfect hockey player. I mean, really, there's really no fault in his game that you can really find, except for maybe his foot speed, which is the same criticism that Nick Suzuki gets. So it's not fair. But then the more you think about it, the more you think like, okay, maybe he won't be a Patrice Bergeron, but he has a lot of the same qualities of a Patrice Bergeron. Maybe a little bit less on the defensive side, but maybe a little bit more skill on the offensive end, in the sense of like his deception with his shot, the way he can deceive. He's a deceptive passer. He uses the angle on his blade to really make defenders and goaltenders look the wrong way very often, and has a really acute understanding of how to do that and does it intentionally. It's not something that just sort of happens by happenstance. It's really an element of his game that he works on and that he implements consciously. So the more you think about it, and Patrice Bergeron was his idol growing up. He wore his number in junior. He was his favorite player and the player that he kind of patterned his own game after. I'm not saying he'll be that player, but it's great to have a player who looks to a player like Patrice Bergeron as a model. Like that's what you want in your organization.
Yeah, I think normally when those player comps get thrown around for young players, it's natural to sort of roll your eyes and be like, okay, come on. But it's because I think fans typically overhype young players on their favorite team. I think player comps are generally kind of lazy because you just latch onto one thing. And especially in this case, you're right, it seems a bit sacrilegious to compare anyone to an all-time great like Bergeron, who has so few flaws in his game. But you do watch it, and I think stylistically what stands out to me, you know, you mentioned the stick work. I think the positioning defensively, which allows him to compensate for the fact that he's not necessarily the biggest, strongest, or fastest guy. He can just kind of get it done through smarts. What really sticks out to me, and it's a very Patrice Bergeron-ish quality, is this kind of innate ability to be in a crowd and come out of that crowd with the control of the puck and then instantly be able to make some sort of a positive play. And we've seen it time and time again where there's a lot of players in this league who can, on the rush with open space and a bunch of ice in front of them, do really high level skill stuff and make crazy passes and shoot the puck. But for him, he's constantly, time and time again, finding himself in these areas where he's got a defender or two on him, and he just comes out of it with the puck and instantly hits someone in stride. And that's like a really rare quality, I think, that is difficult to find in players, and the list of guys who can do that is really low. So that's where the comparison kind of gels for me, where they get it done in a similar way, but that particular area is something that I think is a very rare quality.
Yeah, and the one thing I would say about that as well is that notice how often he puts the puck in an area where his teammate can skate into it. Like he passes to space a lot. Kotkaniemi does this actually really well as well. Where, you know, like a quarterback almost, where you got to throw to a spot where your receiver is going to be. And it seems simple because that's just a basic tenet of passing. You're going to pass the puck to where your teammate will wind up being. But not everyone is able to do that at this kind of a level, and in areas of the ice that are as dangerous as Suzuki tends to do it in. You know, he had a couple of situations against Vancouver. You know, well, when you made that little highlight package of him, there was that little backhand saucer to Petrie, like coming down the middle of the ice all alone. He did that in a crowd. And then the one where he sort of dangled, you know, he did something to Quinn Hughes, but he basically left him in his wake and then sets it on a tee for Jonathan Drouin in the slot for a really high scoring opportunity. And he does stuff like that all the time. And the thing is, he does stuff like that in his defensive zone as well. Like, that's what's crazy, is that he'll wind up, like, you watch him in the defensive zone, and he's done this since junior, is he's what I call a lurker. He lurks. He goes, he swoops around the ice, and he always seems to know when to arrive in an area of the ice at the right moment. And then he'll swoop, and he'll give like two quick strides, and then all of a sudden he has the puck. And not only does he have the puck, he knows what he's going to do with it, and it's on a teammate's stick going the other way before you know it. And so a defensive situation turns into an offensive situation very quickly with him. And that's something Phil Deneau does really well as well. And so it's, you know, for him to have the combination to be able to do that specific thing that you mentioned, but do it in both zones, is what I think makes him a really special and effective player. But it's, let's see. I mean, you know, he's going to, you know, I want to give him some time. He's looked great so far. But, you know, last season, you know, 50 or so games in or 60 games in, he started to slow down a little bit. I think he's more physically ready to face the rigors of a season this year. But, you know, he's 21 years old, so it's he's going to have some bad things happen to him. It's hard to see right now what that will be, because he's playing so well.
That sounded so ominous. He's going to have some bad things happen to him. No, I mean, listen, there's going to be stretches, obviously, where he goes 3 or 4 games without a point, and people are, I'm sure, in Montreal are going to panic about it. But that's kind of what happens over the course of a full season. You know, it's interesting you bring up that lurking, though, because I was thinking as a thought exercise watching these games, where sometimes I wish they'd kind of center him more on the on their power play scheme, in terms of just funneling the offense through him, because he's such a smart player and his touch is so perfect that, you know, you'd think that he could really create more for them, and maybe they'd be better suited not just seemingly kind of catering everything to Weber bombs or kind of passing it around the point. But I think maybe part of the value there is there, like, if you don't have the puck on his stick all the time, he can kind of lurk like that, where he gets lost in coverage. He can create our broken plays with the penalty kill scrambling. And we've already seen it a couple times, whether it was when he set up Tyler Toffoli for that easy tap in, or whether it was him bouncing on that rebound in the opener against the Leafs, where I think a player like him kind of benefits maybe from not necessarily having the puck the entire time, because he's sort of crafty enough to get around the offensive zone and make it count, even though he didn't have it, if that makes sense.
Well, to be honest with you, the Canadiens' intention is to have him quarterback the power play. What I think you're seeing so far is teams are recognizing his threat value. You know, I mean, they really don't. What the teams have done that the Canadiens have faced so far is they don't want the puck in his hands, and he's good enough with the puck and good enough at recognizing that if teams are going to do that, then he's going to get rid of it and try and find an opening that way. But the Canadiens' intent is really to have Suzuki be like the Suzuki Drouin combination on the half wall and at the goal line with Toffoli in the bumper. That triangle is what the Canadiens are trying to exploit on the power play. That's where they want the puck to be, and have Weber be there as a guy who can get lost, as the guy who maybe penalty killers will eventually forget about if that triangle can be dangerous enough, and have Petrie up top as well as the same threat level. That's two right-handed shots, which are one-timers that both Suzuki and Drouin can set up for shots. Weber on the back door, Petrie up top, and Suzuki with that kind of cross-seam pass that last season he did very effectively with Tatar, which was weird, a left shot in that left circle, but he scored a ton of goals from Suzuki setting him up from the right circle over to Tatar in the left circle, and then he would shoot it not on a one-timer, but obviously because he was a lefty, but still would get some really great shots. And that's where his Suzuki's deception comes in, is so many of those came on passes that looked like shots. So the goalie was late getting over because he was anticipating a shot from Suzuki. All of a sudden the puck is clear on the other side of the ice and Tatar had half a net to shoot at. So we haven't really seen that happen yet, but I think it's because teams are coming at Suzuki as soon as he gets the puck and forcing him to get rid of it, because they're recognizing that there's multiple threats when Suzuki has the puck, in terms of who he can pass it to, what he can do with it, and the different and just the level of imagination of the player, I think teams have already recognized that they don't want that. They don't want to face that on the power play.
Well, and what makes them so interesting and or tantalizing as a talent is so it's so kind of counter to what you expect from a Canadiens player over the past couple of years, where he has done a lot of his damage on the power play as opposed to 5-on-5. And I think, listen, like I want it to be clear that I think the sky's the limit for him. I've been wildly impressed by him, and I think that you know he can only go up from here. I mean, he's still only 21 years old, and he has a point in every game. I do think, you know, when we talk about how dominant he's been or where he ranks in terms of the league centers, I think some perspective, though, in terms of the 5-on-5 production does need to be accounted for. We're early in his career. He hasn't necessarily, you know, he's got only, I think, 8 5-on-5 goals so far in the NHL, 24 points. Now, you know, like you alluded to, there's been certainly been opportunities so far this season where he set people up in the slot with beautiful looks, and he could easily become a primary assistant 5-on-5, and that profile would look different. And I think the skill is certainly there. I think the eye test matches the underlying production in terms of how well he's been playing with Anderson and Drouin is all there, and they're going to get their goals if they keep generating the types of shots and chances they have at this point of the season. But that is still sort of the last layer or the last wrinkle to come here, because in his own zone defensively, as we talked about, he's excelled. On the power play, he's a really dangerous threat. Now, if he starts adding that 5-on-5 production to his resume as well, then all of a sudden you're talking about him being in that tier with the top centers.
Yeah, and, you know, I think a lot of his underlying numbers of 5-on-5 last season were not good. They're actually among the worst on the team, and that's where it really didn't match the eye test. You know, I mean, that was really, you watched him play and all you saw was good. But you know, his goals against numbers were very high. His shot numbers were not in his favor. There were a lot of things that went against him at 5-on-5 last season. But the thing about that line, is, you know, Drouin's working on it, but we'll never be a plus defender. You know, we'll never be a player who is all that great without the puck. He's gotten better, and he's made a point of getting better at it, but he'll never be great at it. Anderson's a little bit better, but you know, that so far this season, we have seen moments where they do get stuck in their own end, where they're not able to create a change of possession and get going on offense. There's been entire shifts that they've spent in their own end. And that's only normal, and it's going to happen. They do have the skill and that line has the components in Drouin, Suzuki, and Anderson that really seem to mesh well together. That, you know, three components that you would want on a forward line. But I think the beauty of this for Suzuki, for Kotkaniemi, for Drouin, for some of the guys who have been, maybe not Suzuki, but definitely Kotkaniemi and Drouin, who have been sort of magnets for criticism. Even though Kotkaniemi is only 20, that's actually the case, because this is what my city is like. But the way that the team is made up is that you can sort of hide that stuff. If as long as the other lines are doing well, or as long as someone's producing, the Canadiens are at least going to be in games and in a position to win games. So that, you know, like Jonathan Drouin scored his first goal of the season the other night, you know, in his sixth game. I think in normal circumstances, if Jonathan Drouin went 5 games without a goal to start the season, it would be a thing. It would be a topic of conversation in Montreal that Jonathan Drouin is not scoring. He's a bum. He's never going to be good. They never should have traded Sergachev, blah, 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 blah. No one was talking about it. It was really, I mean, he had a lot of assists. He had those 3 assists on opening night. And, you know, it was a minor talking point that line after that opening night game against Toronto had gone a little cold in Edmonton. And so it became a minor thing. But like Jonathan Drouin was not the focus of attention, which I think is for the first time in his life, really, but really definitely since he's been in Montreal, where that's the case, where he can just be one of 4 or 5 really effective forwards on this team. So if one of them's not going, as long as 2 or 3 of the other ones are, not that big of a deal. And so, you know, the inevitable slumps that Suzuki will have and Kotkaniemi will have and Drouin will have and anyone will have, I think will be offset by the fact that their scoring depth should be significant enough that they can absorb any kind of slump that they seem to hit. As long as those slumps don't coincide, they should be okay.
Yeah, they've currently got 3 of the top 8 lines in 5-on-5 expected goals share in the entire league. So that'll certainly help. But I think, yeah, you're right. Like with Suzuki, Anderson, and Drouin, I think they're hovering around like 70% in terms of shot share and expected goal share. And I think they've scored, right. They've generated 5 goals in 57 minutes, which they'll obviously do. I think they complement each other really well stylistically. It makes sense. And I'm really curious to see how things go for them, because you're right, the depth is there. So the burden necessarily won't be on them. And especially when you have a 5-on-5 line that's kind of as dominant as Dano, Tatar, and Gallagher, it allows them to not have to necessarily carry the burden every single night. And for Suzuki, with what he produces on the power play as well, that's kind of something to factor in. But I did just want to highlight it, because I don't want people to, you know, listen to the first 30 minutes of the show and hear us talking about Suzuki as Patrice Bergeron and think that we've completely gone off the rails here and lost perspective. I do think there that is something that, as if you're telling the full story here in terms of the start of the season, needs to be said. But clearly for a player of his age and certainly the skills and the process are there. So you'd think that those 5-on-5 numbers will come if they keep playing this way.
Yeah. And the beauty of the Dano line is really that to have a line that can stop momentum the way they do, you know, like they're, if the opposing team is gaining some sort of momentum where they spend 2-3 shifts in your end, you can throw that Dano line out there, and frankly, they have not been fantastic through the early. They have not been up to their usual standard, I should say, in terms of controlling play and hemming teams into the offense, into the Canadiens' offensive zone. You know, they could have some improvement on that level, but generally speaking, what that line does for the Canadiens is that they're a momentum buster. Like all of a sudden, you're scrambling around, you're chasing the puck, you're unable to get the puck for a long stretch of time, and then that line comes out and spends its entire shift in the offensive zone, and all of a sudden the next line does it and the next line does it. And so that's a real luxury for a coach to have. You know, there's a few lines around the league that you could do that with, obviously. Most of them aren't as sort of I don't know how you say it, like vanilla, I guess, the way this line is. You know, none of them are superstar players. You know, they're all good, very good players, but they're not star level players, even though I think Gallagher should be, but he's really not considered an NHL star. But you know, again, the three players stylistically fit so well that it works, and they're able to create that offensive zone time, and they're able to give the other lines on the team a little bit of momentum when they come on the ice. But in the past, those other lines weren't all that effective. Like they needed that. Whereas now those other lines can take that and run with it. You know, I mean, potentially, like they could take some of the momentum created by a Dano shift in the offensive end and really start hammering on it. And so, you know, we'll see how that tends to work. But it's the Dano line's greatest value to me is to just get the team to like just take a break, in the sense where If they're getting hammered by the other team, that Dano line is a way to counter that and maybe even flip it. And so they haven't needed that yet so far this season, but they will at some point. And it's good to have in your back pocket when you will.
Yeah, they're kind of like stabilizers. Like you know, you won't go too many shifts in a row stuck in your own zone because you can throw them out once in a while. Yeah, let's save Dano for a second because I do have a bigger point to make on him. But just one last thing on Suzuki. I think it is a testament to how good he's looked that he, you know, just completely played himself out of any possible trade discussion. I know it didn't stop people from talking about it online, but just based on the conversations I've had with people that know a thing or two, like the Habs were never really that far along in the Pierre-Luc Dubois trade discussions, especially towards the end. You know, they were obviously interested. We're like, as hockey writers, we're contractually obligated to mention that 22-year-old number one centers don't become available often, which is a line you've heard quite a bit. And certainly the link is there to his hometown team, wanted to play in a bigger market. I get all that. But it seemed pretty clear from what I gather that, you know, Columbus asked for Suzuki. Bergeron was like, yeah, that's not happening. And that's pretty much it. I don't even know how far down the road they went entertaining a Kotkaniemi or some sort of other package, but it just felt like without Suzuki on the table, because he had played himself out of it, the Canadiens weren't going to beat Winnipeg's offer in terms of kind of present day value. And so that's what happened there.
Yeah, basically. I mean, I think if Bergevin had been willing to trade Suzuki, then that trade would have happened. He clearly wasn't. That's obvious. I think Suzuki and Romanov, I should say, were the two real untouchables in the Canadiens' eyes in that deal. I have not been able to ascertain one way or the other if Kotkaniemi was ever on the table. I would be surprised if the Canadiens were willing to do that. My guess is that they were hoping Columbus could come to an agreement on an extension with Deno, and that he would be a centerpiece along with prospects, you know, perhaps even a Caulfield or a Caden Gooley, some of their higher end prospects, plus draft picks and what have you. But Deno being the guy to like replace Dubois for the now, and then the prospects being the plus for the future. Obviously, if I'm Yarmo Kekalainen, I don't do that. That just makes no sense. But I would insist on at least Kotkaniemi, and that I haven't been able to nail down for obvious reasons, if that was ever on the table. But, you know, for the Canadiens to think, you know, well into Friday night that they were in it to some extent, you got to imagine that their offer was at least somewhat attractive to Columbus. And I'm just, I have no idea what that could have been without either Kotkaniemi involved or a signed and sealed Deno involved. And I don't know to what extent that would even move the needle compared to Laine and Roslovich.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure how close they were actually there, but I do think part of the calculus clearly with Suzuki was, you know, you can argue about Suzuki versus Pierre-Luc Dubois in terms of present day value, but I think clearly for the Canadiens, the appeal of having him at some million, 1 million per year for this year and next, and then four more years of team control. I think, you know, like that sort of financial and contractual consideration for this team is interesting. Cause I remember when you and I did a show together before, we were talking about how they'd sort of lined everything up contractually and how they were trying to figure out, you know, what the next step was and what they were going to do. And now when you kind of look ahead, starting next year, they've got nearly 40 million, I believe, in cap commitments to like Price, Weber, Petrie, Gallagher, and Anderson. And they have Tatar and Deneau coming up as UFAs. And I'm really curious to see what's going to happen there and how they're going to value Deneau, because I think, listen, like for whatever reason, people just seem to really want to pencil Suzuki and Kotkaniemi ahead of him. And I get that he's not the flashiest player. You refer to him as vanilla, but man, he is such a boss of a player. We heard McKinnon recently kind of single him out as the most annoying player to play against. In 1,300 5-on-5 minutes together over the past 2+ years, that line is outscoring teams 81-48 and has north of 60% of the shot share and chance share. They've just been ridiculous. And I think for Deno, we get so preoccupied with just looking at goal and point totals and judging players that way. And it's easy to see when you look at him, career high in 13 goals, I believe, 53 points. Most people that don't watch him closely would say, what's the big deal of that? But here's a fun stat for you. He's got 85-on-5 points the past 2 years. Eichel has 82. Ryan O'Reilly is 79. Barzal is 78. Pierre-Luc Dubois is 77. Like, that's pretty good company. And I think most people wouldn't typically think of Philippe Deneau as this guy that creates a ton of offense and doesn't put up big point totals. But if you look at the underlying numbers, you look at what he does at 5-on-5, he's been one of the best centers in the league for 2+ years now. And he's entering this UFA period where I believe he's going to be 28 years old. The team is kind of positioned for the future. We heard some rumblings about, you know, his place in the organization and how he felt about all of that a couple months ago. I'm really curious to see what's going to happen there and how he's going to be valued moving forward.
Well, you know, the interesting thing here is, okay, so Dubois gets benched on Thursday night. Is that right?
Yep.
On Friday afternoon, La Presse, Mathias Brunet at La Presse gets a scoop that Philippe Deneau, shortly after Jeff Petrie signed his extension in the fall, Philippe Deneau rejected a 6-year, $30 million offer from the Canadiens. This is according to La Presse. Journal de Montréal, later the same day, confirms that and says there were two offers on the table, one for 6x5 at 30 mil, another for 5x5 at 25 mil. Both were rejected by Philippe Deneau, apparently. This comes out the day after Pierre-Luc Dubois gets benched by the Columbus Blue Jackets. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
It's a coincidence.
Oh, yeah.
So, but it's a very tricky situation for the Canadiens, because everything you just mentioned is 100% true. Philip Deneau has every right to be paid accordingly, according to what all the things that you just said and all the things that he has done over the last couple of years. And he is a legitimate Selke caliber center. That's there's no doubt about that in my mind. The question is, to what extent do the Canadians value that? And to what extent does Philip Deneau think he's worth? Like, what does he think he's worth? And so when you look around the league and you look at Jean-Gabriel Pageau's contract with the Islanders, Philip Deneau has every right to say, well, I am way better than Jean-Gabriel Pageau. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no doubt in anyone's mind that he's a more valuable player than J.G. Pageau. And if J.G. Pageau is signing for $5 million a year, then I should be worth at least six, let's say. And at that point, it gets really tricky for the Canadians because of all the other commitments that you mentioned earlier. And because at some point, Suzuki's going to have to get paid. Kotkaniemi's contract is up after this season. He'll likely sign a bridge, but then he'll obviously have to get his big contract as well. Romanov burned a year of his entry level last year by going to the bubble. So his contract will be up in two seasons at the same time as Suzuki's. So there's a lot of financial pressure points coming up. And Deneau's going to have to fit into all of that. And so I don't know what's going to happen there. Honestly, like, I have no idea if the Canadians can afford to keep him, if they think they can afford to keep him. And I don't think Deneau should give them a discount in any way, shape, or form, if I'm him. So it's going to be a tricky situation, but it's very interesting that the news came out that he rejected a six-year offer worth $30 million, which, again, makes you believe that he's looking at the Pageau deal and saying, I'm not taking the same amount as him per year. But how Bergevin navigates this whole thing, particularly with Deneau, and not enough gets said about Tatar. Tatar's been a highly effective offensive player for this, not only for this team, his entire career. I think he's on six straight 20 goal seasons. I mean, you know, not a high end scorer, but a very consistent, effective offensive player, who is going to be hitting 30. And, you know, to what extent the Canadians need, and Canadians are really thin on the left side at forward. And again, this year he's proving that he's a vital player for this team. So how those two situations play out is going to be super, super interesting. But I think one thing's for sure is that they won't be traded at the deadline if things continue going this way. But
I'm not too worried about Tatar just because we saw, I don't think the market's going to change that much this coming off season compared to last year because teams are still going to be up against it financially. And so, you know, when you see what Tyler Toffoli went, for example, and, you know, Craig Smith and these awesome two-way point producing centers that got woefully underpaid just because there wasn't enough money to go around for them. I think I'm not too worried about Tatar. As for Deneau, like, he's going to be turning 28. This is, you'd think, going to be his one chance to really strike big contractually, especially if it's a long-term deal that's going to take him into his early to mid-30s. And he has played like a guy that deserves to be paid for that. And so I think it's just a tricky situation to navigate for the Canadians because I'd really caution against overlooking his contributions and getting too excited about the future of Suzuki and Kotkaniemi down the middle because that is still the engine that kind of makes this team operate and function properly. And if you remove that from the equation, I wonder how everything else would look around them. But it is a pretty good spot for Deneau too, because while he has been this good, I'm not sure necessarily that you could pluck him and put him into a situation where he's having to carry a line with two sort of replacement level wingers beside him. Yeah, and what those results would look like playing with Tatar and Gallagher is a perfect fit for him. And so it's kind of one of those situations where it's a match made in heaven for the player and the team, but just because of other factors, it might get complicated to the point where something kind of unfortunate has to happen for both sides.
Well, the reality of it, and I don't think it would be unreasonable for the Canadians to think of it this way, is that, you know, when they are at their peak level in terms of contender status, Philip Deneau would be the third center on the team. Like, if they become contenders, let's say, that would mean that Nick Suzuki has become a legitimate top line center. Jesperi Kotkaniemi has become a legitimate second line center. And then you have the ultimate luxury of having Philip Deneau as your third center. Then what is that worth? How do you properly price that if he's your third center? The other issue is that they have Jake Evans centering their fourth line. I think I think Jake Evans is going to be a really great fourth line center in this league, maybe even a third line center. And below him, they have Ryan Poehling, a former first round pick, who you could see in a not so distant future becoming a player somewhat similar to Philip Deneau in the sense that he's bigger than Deneau. He can skate more or less at the same level as him. You know, whether he has the same, you know, sort of intelligence aptitude that Deneau does remains to be seen, and probably doesn't, but it wouldn't be unreasonable for them to say, well, Ryan Poehling could become a very good third line center, maybe not as good as Deneau, but would be paid like a third line center and would allow us to fill our salary structure in a more appropriate way. And so it's not necessarily discarding what Deneau means to this team, but it's the reality that as he hits his 30s, his role is going to diminish naturally,
yep,
as these two young centers continue improving. And so how do you price that? It's tough. I don't know. It's a tough one.
It is, but I will say I've seen plenty of teams in this league get themselves into trouble by building their team around the best case scenario of all their young players hitting their absolute ceiling, because we know that it's, unfortunately, that's just not always how the league works, and things happen and players don't develop the way you'd ideally think they would based on their potential and how they looked in smaller roles. And you can't necessarily extrapolate it to say, okay, well, this guy who looks good as a third center is going to look just as good as a second center. That's sometimes not how it works. And so right. I think once you start sort of stripping that depth, which is what's making this team special right now, and asking players to maybe take a step up and play more than maybe they're suited for, that's when you can get yourself into trouble. So obviously, you know, in a cap environment, especially in a flat cap environment right now, there will be casualties and you're going to have to make tough choices. But I do think it's kind of, I think nationally, I'm sure it's being talked about in Montreal, but I think nationally it's kind of being a bit of an undertold story.
Yeah. And I think the actual finances of the league, like I could see Deneau being willing to take a shorter term deal and maybe take another shot at free agency in 2 or 3 years, if the dream contract he's hoping for isn't out there. And that's a real possibility. You know, I mean, the Canadiens were the only team to offer Tyler Toffoli more than a 2-year contract. Like,
yeah,
you know, I mean, and Tyler coming, considering what he's done in LA his whole career, what he did in Vancouver in the short time he was there, that was a really attractive player. And the fact that the Canadiens were the only team that could offer him a 4-year deal, you know, is very telling of what the marketplace was, you know, in the fall and what it will be in all likelihood this summer. So Deneau has to really navigate that. But I would imagine he's not thrilled about the idea that it somehow got out that he rejected those two contract offers back in the fall.
Yeah, but the wing market is different for guys like Toffoli and Tatar. I wonder, like, you know, a team like Minnesota, for example, that has Fiala and Kaprizov now, it's like they need a center so badly. There's any number of teams that could desperately use a Philip Deneau. I do wonder if Columbus. If we'd see some more aggressive offers for him just to land him because he's so good right now. So, right. Yeah, we'll see. I guess one final thing to talk about is the goaltending, because it was such a priority this offseason for them in adding a second goalie they could reliably use to spell Price and not play him as much as they had in the past while still giving themselves a chance to win. You know, so far so good. 2 starts, 2 wins for Jake Allen. Getting 7 goals in the second game of run support certainly helps. But listen, like, I think considering what they've been through the past 2 years, where I believe they won 13 of 31 games, Carey Price didn't start. This was clearly a very kind of pressure point for them, where they had an .888 save percentage from guys like Niemi, Lindgren, and Kincaid. So I know initially, and myself included, I kind of had my eyebrow raised because, you know, so many goalies were going to be available this offseason. St. Louis in particular was so up against it contractually that they had to move Jake Allen. So you looked at it like, it's kind of weird that the Canadiens are the ones paying an asset here and not the other way around to take this contract off their hands. But just considering the cap flexibility they had, the fact that they had 1 million draft picks, and the one they gave for Allen was actually the one that they got for basically renting out Ilya Kovalchuk for like 15 exactly. games. They were uniquely positioned to do so. And I think I also imagine that part of the logic there was they were able to lock up Allen for 2 more years after this one at a reasonable cap hit. And I imagine he'll be appealing to Seattle in the expansion draft. So there was a lot of considerations there, but I do think, you know, it was interesting that they clearly targeted this one player, and we'll see what kind of a role he's going to have this season, because I imagine they're going to want to really scale back Price's appearances in these 56 games.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, they haven't said this bluntly, but I would think the target for Allen is somewhere from 18 to 20 games this year, and have, you know, 36 to 38 for Price. The thing about Allen is, for a long time, the front office, their belief was that, and I think quite reasonably so, but, you know, and a lot of people's belief is that, well, we've decided to pay Price $10.5 million a year. We can't justifiably spend a lot of money on a backup, because that throws your entire cap structure completely out of whack. But what they failed to realize, you know, I use the analogy, or Marc-Antoine Gaudet and I use the analogy during the pause of someone who goes out and buys a really fancy car, but then doesn't spend enough on tires, uses regular gas, goes to the cheap garage instead of going to some expensive garage, just basically does all the cost cutting measures you could possibly do on maintenance because of what they spent on the car initially, to the point where the car no longer functions the way you want it to function.
Right.
That's really what was going on here, was that they spent on the fancy car and they did not want to spend on the maintenance. So now they're spending on the maintenance. And this really came to light 2 years ago when the Canadians, you know, surprisingly were in the playoff race. The Canadians were in California, and they were in San Jose, and they were playing in Anaheim the next night. Anaheim was terrible. San Jose was the real tough game there. And Claude Julien sort of overthought it and played Niemi against the Sharks. He kind of gave that game away, and then he started Price against the Ducks. So the Canadians played amazing against the Sharks and lost solely because of Niemi, and then went to Anaheim and played like garbage and got pumped for like 6 or 7 goals. Price took his stick and broke it over the crossbar, and they lost that game as well. And Niemi never started another game for the Canadians. Price played the last, off the top of my head, like 16 or 18 games that season. So that even if they did get into the playoffs, Price was in no shape to actually play in the playoffs. Like, he was so strung out at that point in terms of playing every night. Even had they made the playoffs, there's no way they would have gotten through a round of the playoffs, because Price would have been exhausted. So they saw that and decided that the solution was Keith Kincaid. like how they thought that was a thing, you know. And that was like, Stefan Waite had a real hole there. Like, their goaltending coach, who I think was big in that signing, was a big factor in that signing, and who looked, you know, to be fair, you know, 2 seasons prior, Kincaid had been lights out for the Devils. He'd been really good, been thrown into a starter's role. But
he got them into the playoffs, I believe.
Got them into the playoffs. Yeah, Schneider was a nightmare, and he really saved them. And so I think they were basing on that. But the season that he had played just before signing with them, he was terrible, and turned out to be terrible for the Canadians. I think he played 3 games before they sent him to the minors. So now they decided finally to spend to buy the premium gas, basically, and to go to the fancy European garage instead of Mr. Lube or whatever. Like, you know, like they basically decided to take care of their high priced car, and we'll see how it goes. So far, I mean, yeah, you're right, the run support on Jake Allen, but in the 2 games, he's looked really solid, and they finally have a backup who plays the puck almost as well as Price does. So it allows the Canadians to play the same way around him, because of how good Jake Allen is at playing the puck. So there's a lot of upside there, but I think you nailed it. The real upside was the extension, and was how attractive Jake Allen will be to Seattle, which will save them from losing a young defenseman like a Victor Mete or a Cale Fleury or a Jake Evans, maybe even up front. Like, they have a lot of young players who are eligible for the expansion draft that they risked losing, that now they maybe won't, because Jake Allen is really going to be an attractive piece to Seattle to form some sort of tandem with like Anton Hudobin or some other goalie that'll be available. There's going to be a lot available to them, but Jake Allen might be the best one.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say like committing $15 million or so in your cap to goalies isn't a good long-term solution, but they clearly viewed it as a one-year kind of aberration or in a vacuum, mm-hmm. here. And you're right. It is protecting your investment. I think they've got Price for another 6 years, including this one. He's 34 this summer. No goalie played more than in the past 2 years. It was clearly something that they needed needed to do. So, yeah, I mean, I guess that is my question with this team to kind of wrap up this conversation, because we've talked about especially their forward depth, how good they've been offensively, how aggressive they've been. We also did mention how that sort of leads to maybe some more high danger chances coming back the other way. And I guess sort of how good this team can be defensively and keeping the puck out of their own net, which includes both the defense and the goalies, is going to be the thing that determines ultimately like what the upside for this team is moving forward, because I feel confident that they're going to score a lot of goals. It's going to be a matter of what type of games they're going to have to be playing and whether they're going to need to be outscoring their problems or whether it's going to be more sort of comfortable sailing.
The one thing I think that they've done is they've built a defense that they believe will be more effective in the playoffs than it is in the regular season. You got Shea Weber, Ben Chiarot, and Joel Edmondson, just those three are guys that you could see once the whistles get put away in the playoffs, those guys will be more effective. You know, I mean, I just remember, you know, from a decade ago, Hal Gill was a terrible regular season defenseman, but you loved having him on your team in the playoffs because no one called anything. So he could hold guys, he could tug on guys, he could do all sorts of things that he wasn't allowed to do. Then he becomes a lot more effective, and he can play against a Sidney Crosby and actually be effective and not look like a fool. And so I think that that's the hope, is that the defense they've built is yes, they're going to have moments during the regular season where they look slow and where they look like they're having trouble keeping up with a lot of the sort of the high-end offensive players that are in the division. Once you get into the playoffs and the rules get sort of loosened a little bit, those guys might become a lot more effective. And so, and with arrested Price, we'll see. He hasn't been great so far this season. I thought he was good in Toronto, even though he gave up, you know, five goals or whatever.
He's been asked to make a lot of tough saves.
He has, and he's made a lot of tough saves. But you know, he hasn't. The numbers don't look good. So that's always the thing with Price, is that, you know, this is why he wins the player poll every year for who would you want in nets for a game seven. I think part of it is that no other goalie has really taken the mantle as world's number one goalie. But a lot of it has to do with the way he intimidates shooters. Like, he really has an ability to get into the heads of offensive players and make them feel like they need to make a perfect shot to beat him. And having that is somewhat of an advantage, but it's a real advantage in the playoffs if he's on his game. And I think we saw it in the summer when Pittsburgh couldn't get anything by him. And even Philadelphia didn't score that much on him. It's just that the Canadiens couldn't score on Carter Hart. So
what did that executive,
we'll see, but that's a good point.
What did that executive say to Craig Cousins? He looks like he's going to stop the puck. That was funny.
Yeah.
That was funny.
Yeah.
That was classic like NHL executive. Yeah. Oh, he looks absolutely. He's going to stop it. Did he stop it?
It makes me think of the scene in Moneyball where they talk about the guy's girlfriend.
Yeah.
Like he's got an ugly girlfriend, so he must be have low self-confidence or something.
Like, I know.
All scouting speak, but I, you know, speaking of players, like there is Carey Price does have an ability to make a player think like, I need to hit the top corner here or there's no chance, and they wind up missing the net. And that's a real thing. Like that actually exists with him. So, but we'll see. I think you nailed it. The big question marks for this team is how can they survive the regular season when I think the defense is going to have some issues from time to time. And I think the goaltending is probably going to be an issue from time to time, but up front they look pretty good.
Yeah, I think you seem to be higher on Joel Edmondson than I am still. Like, for me, watching that Toronto game, I get it. It was the first game.
It was awful.
I understand all of it. I think his ability to deal with incoming speed is not going to get better, unfortunately. And I totally get that, you know, it's a different climate in the playoffs. And at the same time, though, like that Hal Gill calm, the NHL is different now than it was 10 years ago. And I do think eventually they're going to need to explore maybe bumping Kulak up to play with Petrie. And they had great success last year, so I'm kind of curious to see when that's going to happen. But I do understand, like, having Kulak and Romanov as sort of this like super duper sheltered third pair is a pretty nice little luxury for Claude Julien.
It is, but it's also like the reason you would do that is because Edmondson's not being effective. So do you really want to anchor Romanov with this ineffective defenseman who's slow and is having trouble defending, frankly, and is getting caught up ice a ridiculous number of times.
I know, it's bizarre.
So it's really weird. do you really want to hamper like your stud rookie defenseman by pairing him with a guy like that? Like, I think Kulak's perfect for him because Kulak can skate and he can make decisions and he can, you know, he set up a great goal by Suzuki the other night. He's a good defense. Like, I like him as a mobile, smart defenseman and a good partner for Romanov. Putting Edmondson back there, you know, you don't want to be asking your rookie defenseman to start cleaning up the mistakes of your veteran partner. Like, that's really not an ideal situation either.
It is, but I think the exposure is a bit different because especially so far, I think Julian's done a nice job of getting Romanov out against like fourth lines and a lot of offensive zone opportunities. And I think if you're going to have Edmondson with Petrie in that top four role, that's kind of exposing him to a much higher risk of what's going to happen in your own zone. Whereas at least in the third pair and more offensive opportunities, like the damage can be kind of limited to an extent. But I mean, it's if we're talking about this, about a player you just signed for 4 years, $14 million, that's obviously not ideal. So I think they're still kind of holding out hope that experiment is going to get better over time.
Well, that's the reason why you think that I'm higher on Edmondson than you are, is because I'm willing to give them some benefit of the doubt, because I thought this exact same thing about Ben Sherratt a year ago, and Ben Sherratt proved me wrong to a certain extent. He didn't have a wildly successful season, but he was much better than I thought he would be. And so I'm willing to give Joel Edmondson some time. I didn't like the signing either. I didn't like the move. I don't think it was a smart thing to do, but because I thought the exact same things about Ben Sherratt, I'm willing to give Edmondson some time. But so far, let's say the results have been mixed.
Yeah, Sherratt's certainly been much better than I thought he'd be. I guess you could also point to Carl Alsner, though, as a potential thing that balances it out. So.
Well, I think Carl Alsner is why people, like so many people were saying that Ben Sherratt is the next Carl Alsner, that I actually wrote a piece on, even though I didn't like the signing, I wrote a piece on why Ben Sherratt is not the next Carl Alsner. Whereas Joel Edmondson, to me, you know, it's not exactly like Carl Alsner. The thing about Carl Alsner is that they just failed to identify to what extent a change of system could have an impact on a player. You know, like, he'd played a man-to-man system his whole life. He'd never played his own system, and he just wasn't able to. Like, he never was able to adapt to it. At least Edmondson played the same defensive system in St. Louis. So they did learn in that way, but he did play man-to-man last year in Carolina. And, you know, he is a bigger guy, a bit slower, not the fleetest. You know, he's not completely immobile, but he's not the quickest guy on earth.
He struggles with incoming speed.
Yeah, he does. And which is why his tendency to dive backdoor in the offensive zone so often is baffling to me. Obviously he's being told to do that, or right. else, or he's not being told not to do that. Either way, that needs to change. Like, you need to tell him to stop doing that, or stop telling him to do that, because it takes like a deficiency in his game and magnifies it when he's, you know, when he's being forced to get back, when he's being forced to get back after being caught on a pinch or whatever. Like, you see Romanov do the same thing, and he's back because he can skate like the wind, you know, but Edmondson clearly can't. So we'll see. But I think you've properly identified the sort of the areas of their game that could become problematic. The thing that they have going for them is that those exact same areas are problematic on almost every team in the division.
Yeah.
So it works out that way.
Yeah, they don't need to be the best team. They just need to be the best North Division team, or even the second best in the regular season, and take their chances in the playoffs. So they're well on their way there. I've really enjoyed watching them through these first six games. I'm really curious to see a larger sample, especially against better competition, which they won't get much of this season. But I want to see more games against the Leafs, because that first one was really fun. The pace it was played at was incredible. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to make for a heck of a matchup.
I really hope, you know, the last two games of the season are in Toronto and in Montreal. And if first in the division comes down to those two games, that'll be great. That would be great theater. Actually, the best thing would be if fourth in the division came down to those two games, but I don't think that's very likely.
Yeah.
So it's for drama's sake, it would be great if the division actually came down to those two games.
Yeah, just something on the line. All right, Arpen, well, this was a blast. I'm glad we got to do this. Plug some stuff. Where can people check you out? What are you working on these days?
Well, plugging away at theathletic.com, you know, /Montreal if you want to see the Canadian stuff. But yeah, we have a lot of stuff coming out. You know, we're doing a weekly video review of a player This year, we're doing this weekly cool weekly notebook with Marc-Antoine Godet, and I are sort of gathering news throughout the week, and we sort of drop this sort of comprehensive package on where the Canadians are every Friday that we're really excited about. The first one came out last Friday, exploring their cap situation, so look out for that. But otherwise, you know, daily coverage of the Canadians at theathletic.com.
Awesome. Well, this was a blast, man, and hopefully we'll be able to chat soon.
All right. Thanks, man. Had a lot of fun.
Follow on Twitter at Dim Filipovich and on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/hockeypediocast.